ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the face of it, Australia's luck is set to run out as the world moves to net zero. We're among the biggest exporters of coal and gas, but there's something else we could export, something we'd be much better at making in large quantities than just about every country on Earth. It's green iron and green aluminium and a lot of other green products manufactured here using our near unique blend of sunlight, wind, minerals, and acres of space. Getting there wouldn't be cheap. We'd need to make unheard of amounts of electricity, and we'd need to upend our economy. We'd need to become an economic superpower. Could we? Is this the sort of Australia we'd choose if we could choose our own Australia? And are we even up for it? Welcome to Choose Your Own Australia, a special three-part series from The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and my very special guests, two people who know an awful lot about the superpower opportunity and whether or not it might fall from our grasp, Ingrid Burford, who's the carbon pricing and policy lead at the Superpower Institute. She'll tell us about the Institute in a moment. And Ben Potter, who's contributing editor at The Energy, a new news site about energy. Welcome, Ingrid, and welcome back, Ben.
Thank you, Peter. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Great to be back, Peter.
Ingrid, tell us first, what is the Superpower Institute? Where did it come from?
We're a relatively new think tank. We were established in 2023 by the economists Ross Garnaut and Rod Sims.
People have heard of them. They're quite famous, right?
They are. It's a privilege to be working with them and all my other colleagues. And we were established with a single purpose, and that's to help Australia seize the extraordinary economic opportunities that will be created as the world decarbonises and then later as it becomes a post-carbon economy.
So you're a bit like evangelists and also enablers working out how we can do it. Tell us about the vision. Where does it begin? I'm guessing it begins with the world committing to net zero. Now, what follows from that?
You guess correctly. It does begin with the expectation that the world will reach net zero carbon emissions. As the world decarbonises, it's going to need to electrify things. So at the household level, that means driving EVs instead of petrol cars, things like that. But it also has to happen for industries. And so that means that industries that currently use, you know, metallurgical coal and thermal coal and gas to produce these incredibly energy-intensive products are going to need to, as much as possible, electrify. And that's going to massively increase countries' demand for electricity. So for our trading partners, like Korea and Japan, that's sort of in the vicinity of about three times an increase in their electricity demand. For China, it's four times. And for India, it's even larger, up at about 12 times. And then, of course, there's this question of whether those countries can meet that demand. And the answer is that even China, which has actually, you know, quite good renewables by most international standards and a reasonably ambitious nuclear build-out pattern, even China will not be able to. And so what will happen is that these countries will need to find a way to meet their electricity demand. And that's where Australia steps in as a superpower, because we have this extraordinary capacity to generate renewable energy. We have this vast landmass and we have a very small population. So our domestic demand is very small, and that's what helps to keep that price down.
Where would it be? I ask this because I think I've seen a map which has the world's solar resources, if you like, good sun, the world's wind resources mapped on them. A lot of them are in Australia, plus space. Where would these installations be?
So we have remarkable solar and wind at many locations around Australia. What we'd expect to see happen is that we'd see these superpower export industries emerge in hubs where there's a combination of that extraordinary solar and wind, but also access to ports and access to minerals and renewable carbon, either locally or through those ports. And those locations are places like the Eyre Peninsula in South Australia, Oakajee, which is in the Midwest of WA, and Barcaldine up in central Queensland, but you can access that through the port at Gladstone.
Ben, the vision is that we're uniquely positioned. Are we the only country that can do this? Surely we shouldn't be, in the words of Kylie Minogue, so lucky.
Peter, the answer is emphatically no. We're not the only country that wants to do it or can do it, although we have the unique advantages that you and Ingrid have outlined. One thing we've lacked is an economy-wide carbon price. Europe has that, and I think as a consequence of that, a company in Sweden called Stegra is planning to commission the first commercial green iron plant. This is a direct reduction iron electric arc furnace plant using green hydrogen by the end of next year. So that's in less than 18 months if they stick to their plans. And then there are those sun-drenched petro states around the Gulf of Arabia. Those countries are redirecting their petroleum billions of dollars into green energy developments, I think as a hedge, but also to take advantage of their own solar resources.
So it's something of a race. What's the upper limit to the opportunity for Australia, as you and the Superpower Institute see it, Ingrid? How much of the world's iron could we conceivably make? How much of the world's aluminium, aviation fuel and other things?
At the moment, Australia produces about 40% of the world's iron ore and about 30% of its bauxite. So what we could do is to process that here and to move up the value chain and turn that into 40% of the world's green iron and 30% of the world's green aluminium.
We could make 40% of the world's iron.
Not just iron, Peter, but green iron.
Well, all of the world's iron, I assume, would be green by then. What else could we make and in what sort of quantities?
We think Australia has the combination of location and resources and strong trade relationships that mean we could make up to a quarter of the world's green silicon and polysilicon, which we hear about a lot, of course, at the moment, but also green ammonia and urea, industrial methanol, and those long-distance fuels that we're going to need for shipping and aviation and long-distance trucking.
If we did that, what could it do to the world's emissions? Now, if we cut our own emissions, we can't do that much. We're about 1% of the world's emissions, a third of 1% of the world's population. What sort of contribution could we make?
So work by my colleague Ruben Finnegan suggests that we could contribute to reductions worth between 7 and 10% of the global total by 2060, which is a pretty remarkable achievement. So
little Australia by itself, if we make this much, if we win the race, if we make this much of the world's green iron, green aluminium and other things, we could displace 7 to 10% of the world's emissions.
Yeah, that's right. And the reason those numbers are so big is that it's important to remember that the industries we're talking about are incredibly energy intensive. And so at the moment, we're making those really energy intensive goods with fossil fuels. So just to take an example, if you think about a ton of steel at the moment, that includes about 2.2 tons of carbon dioxide emissions. And so if you replace that steel with green iron and green steel, you're displacing nearly all of those emissions with a product that produces hardly any. So as you bring those green products online, you're doing a huge amount of lifting to displace that really carbon-intensive production that we have at the moment.
What's the size of the financial benefit to Australia? What could we earn and how would it compare with what we earn at the moment from exporting coal and gas?
Well, based on the numbers I outlined earlier, we think that these industries could be worth up to $1 trillion by 2060, which is the year that China...
That's per year?
Per year.
$1 trillion.
That's correct. It's a very big number. We typically say that, you know, coal and gas are worth about $120 billion a year at the moment in export revenues to Australia. So they're two out of our three top exports. And so what we're aiming to do is to, you know, as they come down through time, to replace those with revenues from the green superpower exports, which are worth potentially eight times more by 2060.
Ben, would all this be easy? Let's talk about land. We'd need to use 1% of our land for electricity, which is actually quite a lot. We'd need to use 5% of it, according to the Superpower Institute, for biomass. That's also a lot. You've spent a lot of time covering the resistance of farmers and others to simple things like stringing up transmission lines. There's also native title. Would this sort of thing be at all easy in Australia as we know it?
None of it's going to be easy, Peter. And the land question is one of the most difficult challenges of the whole vision. I mean, I've visited farmers that are in, you know, within a few hours' drive of Melbourne, and they're particularly up in arms about major transmission projects that involve 70-metre-high towers running through their lands. But in general, I think the loudest voices on this question may not be the majority, and farmers are going to be challenged by climate change and extreme weather, probably one of the most challenged industries. So I kind of retain the fond hope that over time the appeal of reliable income from biomass production and wind and solar farms and poles and wires will become more compelling. There's also a growing agrivoltaic movement in Europe and the US. I think it's got a toehold in Australia, but we're a little bit behind that.
What's agrivoltaic?
Agrivoltaics is the combination of, say, solar panels and livestock grazing in a field. I think it's been found that the animals like shade just like we do, and they actually thrive in that environment.
And the grass grows under the panels. I've seen the videos. It looks wonderful.
Thank you for equipping me with a new term there. I hadn't heard it, agrivoltaics, before, but I'm delighted that I have.
Yes. No, it is pretty impressive. So, look, I think, you know, attitudes can change, but obviously this is a big problem.
Ingrid, for electricity, you say we'd need to make about 9,000 terawatt hours. Now, right now we make 200 terawatt hours. Where would we get the workers to even do it, particularly in these locations, which are not places where people normally live?
Well, one of the things about the Australian workforce, Peter, is that it's incredibly skilled and it's highly responsive and it's highly mobile. And we know that because it's the backbone of our mining and our resource industries. Now, that doesn't mean we're perfectly set up for the scale of renewable investments that we're going to need. They'll be on a scale that we haven't tried to navigate before. And if we don't plan for that, what it means is that we're going to have workforce shortages and material bottlenecks, which will slow down the installation pace and it will push up prices. So the best way to manage those workforce challenges is to anticipate them. We need a really strong policy signal about what's around the corner. And ideally, that's part of a green export industry strategy that's going to create those strong incentives for the workforce that we'll need.
Let's turn to the fruits of success. Ben, I'm wondering how our economy would cope. If we get all of this income, it would force up the value of the Australian dollar, it would make our buying power huge, but it would make just about every other industry uncompetitive. We'd be the Saudi Arabia of the late 21st century. Would we be even open to this sort of change, to buying almost everything from overseas?
Well, Peter, I feel like it's a bit premature to be answering this classic economist question on the so-called Dutch disease.
We should be so lucky once again.
Well, precisely, yes. Before we get there, we'd need to largely realise the green energy superpower vision, and that'd be a historically colossal achievement, greater than the 1950s expansion of industry and manufacturing. And it would be a good problem to have, but it's a serious problem, and it would require, you know, some careful thought and planning. Redistributive tax policies, perhaps even a super profits tax of some kind. We already do purchase a lot of, or really most of our non-food and beverage consumer goods from overseas, so that dimension of the problem may not be a huge step. But there's a huge amount to achieve before we have to grapple with this problem, I feel.
Have you grappled with it at the Superpower Institute, Ingrid? It seems to me like an economy that does nothing other than do these industries and the industries that support them.
Oh, we've certainly given it a lot of thought. We've been modelling what the superpower might look like out to the middle of the century. And, you know, as Ben has pointed out, what will happen is that those booming superpower exports will drive up demand for the Australian dollar, drive up the price, drive up our terms of trade, and that will make it harder for other export industries to compete. And we've experienced that before here in Australia. We experienced that during the mining boom. So, for example, you know, in 2010, at the peak of that boom, the Australian dollar actually hit parity with the US.
It was wonderful. We could go online and buy anything at US dollar prices.
That's right. So, you know, what happened then and what will hopefully happen in the future if we can get this superpower vision off the ground is that Australia was and will be very wealthy. That high dollar makes it cheaper for us to import goods. It did, as you pointed out, also make it harder for other exports to compete. So it's always, I think, important to remember that trade makes us collectively better off, but it does make some people worse off. And so it's absolutely crucial for the purposes of social cohesion, social support for this, to use that shared wealth to benefit all Australians.
To do that, we cannot be anti-trade. What about the rest of the world, Ben? We're seeing a lot of move away from free trade at the moment, a move toward self-sufficiency. If the rest of the world doesn't want to buy things from Australia, the Saudi Arabia of the second half of the 21st century, the vision's in trouble, right?
Well, it's a challenge, Peter, and you're very correct to say that free markets are not the zeitgeist in the era of China-US great power rivalry. And Hugh Mackay is an economist at ANU and a former market analyst at BHP for a long period, I think 8 years. And he points out, and have to stress, he doesn't want to be the naysayer on the green energy superpower vision, but he does point out that China, which is the world's largest steel and aluminium producer and therefore a key market for Australia's green iron and other commodities, should we go down that path, has invested very heavily in traditional blast furnace, basic oxygen furnace steelmaking in the last 20 years. That's how it became the largest steelmaker. And Hugh's point is that they're not going to want to abandon those investments too soon, or, you know, before their economic lifetime is up. And therefore, they will pursue green iron technology options that tend to preserve as much of those assets as they can. They've also got very large aluminium investments. So the economics of comparative advantage are appealing. Australia's, I think, belief and the basis of a lot of policy in the last 30 or 40 years that led to increased prosperity is that ultimately comparative advantage prevails because of the economic and cost pressures that Ingrid has outlined. And therefore, the rest of the world will be prepared to buy green commodities from us, perhaps not in the quantities envisaged by the Superpower Institute. I kind of feel, although I want to believe in the vision in full, that their stretch targets, and Superpower Institute itself points out that, you know, even if you got a halfway there, it would still be a massive increase in Australia's exports and a big boost to our prosperity.
Ingrid, another roadblock might be the rest of the world not wanting to decarbonise. We, in fact, might have massive stranded assets. We might be building all of these things and they mightn't come.
It's a big what if. We don't know how the future will play out, but here's how I think about it. So I think there's broadly three possible futures. One is a future where the world doesn't decarbonise. One is a future where the world does decarbonise and Australia makes the most of its comparative advantage and prospers. And then the third version is the world decarbonises and we don't seize that opportunity. Now, if the world doesn't decarbonise, you know, the social, the political, the economic costs of that are absolutely astronomical. You know, in that version of the world, the lost investments we've made in the superpower industries will be absolutely trivial by comparison. So we cannot plan and we should not plan for a world that's not going to reach net zero. So the question is then whether or not we plan for Australia to prosper if the world does decarbonise. And if we do not have the right policies in place, there's a very real risk that we'll squander that opportunity. And we can't wait. It's important to point that out. We cannot wait because those green export industries cannot get established overnight. We need large-scale renewable energy installations and we need new common user infrastructure to make this happen. And, you know, to even get that off the ground, we need the right regulatory settings and the right market incentives.
Well, let's talk about how we could get that off the ground if we were planning to Choose Our Own Australia, which is the title of this special summer series of The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and energy specialists Ingrid Burford and Ben Potter. Ingrid, what would we need to get us there? Now, I reckon you're going to tell me a carbon price would help, but if we can't get that, what would we need to achieve this colossal vision?
I think what we'll see is that, you know, there's already about 80 forms of carbon price already around the world, and we'll continue to see those expand and deepen. You know, China's got an emissions trading scheme up. This year it was expanded to cover cement and iron and steel making. Japan is introducing a scheme voluntarily initially, but becoming compulsory soon. Carbon pricing is on the march, for lack of better description. And as countries price their carbon, they have a natural incentive to apply a carbon border adjustment mechanism, as Europe already has, so to tax the carbon embedded in the products that they import. So all of those things will strengthen the signal and the demand for the green exports that we would like to produce here in Australia.
So what would our government need to do? Would we need something like the Future Made in Australia program or the US Inflation Reduction Act, where we hand out lots of money to people who want to set up solar, wind farms, iron production in remote parts of Australia?
Well, I feel like it's a waste of an economic podcast not to get in something about both supply and demand. So I'm going to do that now, Peter. It's about both sides of the market. On the supply side, we need policies that I think apply across the board for any businesses. So that means we need to speed up approvals processes. You know, that's been a big theme at the Productivity Roundtable, absolutely crucial. We also need to keep a really, really steady eye on the economic fundamentals. So that's things like a low and predictable interest rate and policy certainty. But there are a couple of levers that we need to pull that are specific to those superpower exports. There's this phenomenon that we often call the green premium, because it's more expensive to make green goods, and that's because carbon-based production isn't paying for the damage that it does. So what we propose is a production tax credit. You know, we've recommended that recently for green iron, and that creates that market signal that will emerge soon internationally, but in the meantime creates the incentive for firms to get up. And we'd like to see support for innovation, because one of the things that is the case in these large-scale projects is it's incredibly difficult to figure out the new technology, to train new workers. We've talked a bit about that. To figure out how to do it, this is a new process. It hasn't been done at scale. And so we recommend support for those early first-of-a-kind producers to get that innovation up so that future producers benefit.
Ben, as someone who used to write for the Financial Review, does this set off alarm bells in your mind? Handing out grants to people who have good ideas and want to develop something.
Well, Peter, carpetbaggers and opportunists are a big problem around industrial subsidy programs. But, you know, I think our federal government has become pretty good at this. So I don't think we need to kind of tear our hair out about this challenge. We do already have two green banks, the Clean Energy Finance Corporation and the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, with slightly different remits around the level of commerciality in the projects they fund. And I think they've got fairly clean track records over about 15 years since they were put in place under the Rudd and Gillard Labor governments. Some losses are inherent in these kind of programs, and commentators have, you know, dined out endlessly on the Obama-era US loans program that lost $500 million on a solar technology company called Solyndra. But they tend to ignore the fact that that program also made loans to Tesla that turned out to be a fabulous success and I think have been repaid.
So some losses along the way mightn't be that much of a problem given the size of the opportunity. Can I come at this another way, Ingrid, putting my hat on as a critic of the superpower vision of needing any government support? If the case for it is so clear, if Australia's advantage is so big, why would people, companies, trying to take advantage of it need any support from us, any support from the government.
This is the won't it happen anyway question.
Yes.
It is absolutely true that as the world decarbonises, the demand for green exports will emerge organically. And it's also true that the slower out of the blocks the world is in that decarbonisation race, you know, the more rapidly we'll need to move and the stronger those incentives will be. But this is a question of readiness. And so it's a question of whether we've already done the hard work getting past those early first-of-a-kind projects. And that learning is difficult. It's not to be underestimated. It's innovation is really hard and future industry will benefit. And it's also whether or not we've done the hard work of anticipating and planning for that shared infrastructure that we'll need that will make it possible for private investment to follow.
Ben, I'm wondering whether we're even up for these challenges. I ask that because Australia's not what it was. We're not the bold country of my youth. Remember those first, you probably don't, Ingrid, but those first dollar notes and $20 notes we had, they were bright, they were vibrant. The ones we have now are pastel and muted. So are our ambitions. As you would expect, as the population ages, we've become more complacent. Are we, do you think, actually up for this sort of big challenge anymore? Do we seriously want to be rich, as they say?
Well, Peter, I agree there's a puzzling lack of national ambition among many critics of the energy transition and to the extent that they grapple with it at all, the green superpower vision. But I think on this, the better question to ask maybe, do we seriously want to be poor? Because we're going to lose our second and third largest exports being coal and gas. The only question is whether that unfolds over one, two or three decades or so. Substantially, they'll be gone. So I think the question, the answer really is that we have no choice. And the question is how fully we embrace the opportunity. And I think popular support may be broader than you'd think. Because many ordinary Australians do wonder why we're content to export unprocessed ores and other minerals.
Ingrid, I think you've just convinced Ben.
Well, like I said, we have a single goal at the Superpower Institute, so at least I've delivered on that today.
But in order to achieve that goal, all sorts of things come into it. Tax, income distribution, everything. It's a transformation, but I suppose, and Ross Garneau, one of the founders of the Superpower Institute, knows a lot about this, Australia's been through a few transitions. One that he was part of was getting rid of our tariffs. We were one of the richest countries in the world from wool some time ago, pushed up our exchange rate like you wouldn't believe, and then, sort of unexpectedly, one of the richest countries in the world from minerals, as China industrialised. I suppose these transitions seem difficult until you're in them.
I think the story you've just told, the narrative you shared, is a testament to two things. It's to the importance of open trade, because that is really what has made Australia the wealthy country it is today, whether it was gold or then wool and wheat, then minerals and fossil fuels. Australia is a country that has benefited tremendously from open trade and being prepared to import and export. And the story we've been talking about today, you know, the superpower vision, is about the next generation of that. It's about the next industrial era for Australia as we move away from fossil fuels while the world decarbonises.
Ingrid, I'm meant to be a skeptic in this role. I'm fighting it hard. I'm becoming excited, but there's a lot of work to happen, and it's not going to happen all at once, as you say. Ingrid Burford, policy lead at the Superpower Institute, and Ben Potter, contributing editor at The Energy. Thank you so much for outlining it on The Economy Stupid.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure to be on the podcast, Peter. Thank you.
And thank you for listening. This has been the first in a special three-part series of The Economy Stupid entitled Choose Your Own Australia. You can find the other parts right now on the ABC Listen app. If you've any thoughts or questions or comments about the series, no economic question is stupid, you can email us, theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.